Disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show! Welcome to this emergency call-out edition of the podcast. I was sitting around on Saturday, and I realized, hey, I leave for Casadia Comic-Con on Wednesday morning, like early in the morning, and I do not have time between Monday and Tuesday to tape and produce and edit and cut together a show. So I sort of slapped this together at the last minute on Saturday, just grabbed whoever was around and wanted to be on the program. Might be a little slapdash, might be a little off-topic, but I didn't want to go another week without a show, so here you go. Hopefully it'll be a fun time. And don't forget to check AnimeNewsNetwork.com. We're going to be covering San Diego Comic-Con in full. We'll have all the anime and manga panels you can possibly want. All, of course, while we're waiting in line 6 hours for the Game of Thrones panel. So if you run into us at the show, be sure to say hi. And don't forget, check AnimeNewsNetwork.com for San Diego Comic-Con coverage. Okay, let's get to the show.
There's another bag of mail.
Wonderful.
That's all of it, fella. Now listen, you must have a lot of friends to send you all them letters, huh?
No, I don't have any friends. I wrote these letters myself.
Yourself? Why would you want to read a bunch of letters that you wrote yourself?
Oh, I'm not going to read them. I am going to count them.
Oh, yeah, well, sure. Well, have fun.
One.
Okay, first up, these are two grown men who answered the call to talk about Harry Potter for our first segment. It's Corey Proft from the Beta Male Experience podcast, which you can find at betamaleexperience.com, and Evan Minto from anagamers.com, right? .com?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, anagamers.com. All right, guys, Harry Potter. So the new movie's out, final movie's out. I don't know if you guys saw, but it's on track to smash, totally obliterate the opening weekend all-time record. It's projected to do $180 million, which beats The Dark Knight's $154
million. Wow.
That's a projection, but it would have to sink like a stone and be totally wrong in order not to beat Batman. But, yeah. And biggest midnight opening of all time as well, $43.5 million. Just at midnight screenings.
Oh, God.
Wow.
So lots of money. That's a lot of scratch. And I saw the movie. You guys saw the movie. I guess, Evan, let's start with you. What'd you think of the flick?
I thought I don't know if I'd call it the best one. I definitely thought when I saw the first half, part one of the movie, that was the best Harry Potter movie I've seen so far. I might need a little bit more time to think it over, but it's one of the best ones. Like David Yates has got the atmosphere down really well for the movies at this point, because I think the first few were pretty bad, and it kind of really ramped up, and I think it did a pretty good job with what I think was a pretty awful story to begin with. I'm a fan of the books, but I think the seventh book was particularly bad. I think it worked. I certainly got excited at a number of points. There are a lot of really good action scenes, and I think he brought back a good number of the characters, not as many as I would have liked, but he brought back some of the actors and characters that we've seen throughout the series.
All right. I can't really disagree with any of that. Corey, you are not someone who has read the books or a fan of the books.
One of the dozens of people in the world.
Well, and in particular, you're not really a fan of this series of films, are you?
I've grown less fond of them as they went on.
Really?
Less fond?
Usually the opposite for pretty much everyone else.
Apparently. How I looked at it was, I came into them, obviously not reading the books, but I liked the third and fourth ones, and I figured out, I was thinking about this on my way home because I just got back from it, was that the Yates trilogy or pseudo trilogy, as they more and more became more serialized, I grew more and more confused as to the story and where it was going, to the point where the seventh one, part one, I actually didn't really enjoy at all. I was actually kind of miffed by that. I tried to watch it twice, and both times it left me completely cold.
Was it because you were confused?
Yeah, that, and it seemed to have no momentum. It kind of just dead stops in the very long camping trip that they have.
Yeah, that was part of my problem with the book, too.
I thought the movie totally fixed that and made it interesting and compelling and beautiful to look at. But anyway, sorry, go on.
But yeah, I think you guys bring up a great point that I think this last one was still astonishingly beautiful. I think that's the reason why I come to these repeatedly. And I think there were some great character moments, and I wholly enjoy the cast implicitly because of the high caliber actors they have in there. And so it's always a joy to see like a huge, high caliber cast do something that they love. And overall, I thought the story was clunky as hell and kind of weird, you know.
Yep.
I missed a few things. A few things went over my head. But overall, I actually liked it. I enjoyed it while I was sitting in it. I don't know when I revisit it, but yeah, I'm positive on it. So
yeah, I mean, I came away from it immensely emotionally satisfied. Like, it's a very emotionally satisfying movie if you're a fan and you care about these characters and the story. But not even Yates could fix the end of that book. Like, that's really, like, the minute it goes to white, I was like, oh, shit, this is that, like, 50-page info dump that's in the book Gandalf, sorry, Dumbledore.
Yeah.
Whatever, who cares?
You call him Gandalf? Perfect.
Dumbledore shows up and is just like, hey, Harry, here's what's going on forever. In the book.
The epilogue's really bad, but all the stuff before the epilogue, it pretty much goes downhill in both the book and the movie.
Well, yeah, but the movie, I feel like, was exciting enough, and it just kept skipping right along. It's only 2 hours, which I think was a big help.
Yes.
it's only 2 hours. It skips right along. And frankly, like, the entire emotional center of the whole story is actually a really, really beautiful segment in the middle of the film where you find out about who Snape really is and his character. It's great stuff. Like, that was really well handled. I was really impressed with it.
Actually, in the book, I didn't like that so much because I felt like J.K. Rowling pulled the Snape is a good guy thing out of nowhere.
A lot of that.
But in the movie, Yates made that flashback scene really beautiful, and I there were like lots of nice effects as well as just, you know, good acting and good like composition. And that actually, like, I cared about Snape there, whereas I didn't care about him so much in the book.
Well, his character arc just makes more sense in the movie. Like, it just clicks together so much better in the films. And I'm a big proponent that I think the movies are vastly better than the books that they're based on, just because due to the constraints of filmmaking, they have to cut out the chaff that J.K. Rowling just dumps into every book. I mean, Order of the Phoenix is like the most bloated thing in the world. And to wit, that's probably one of the worst movies just because it's kind of a bloated info dump that isn't very exciting. But and in terms of Deathly Hallows Part 2, we talk about these as though they're two separate movies. This is clearly the second half of a long movie, to the point where I had to remember, like, oh, right, that Resurrection Stone thing. Because they don't really explain. They just assume that you just finished watching the first one.
Totally forgot about that. I was like, what is that rock again? And then they kind of...
It's okay. As far as I'm concerned, like, the Deathly Hallows shouldn't have been the name of the book because they were not actually, like, really... They kind of came out of nowhere and weren't so central to the overall story.
I was going to ask about that. Yeah. Was like, why did they call it Deathly Hallows when it seemed like they had no real integral thing in the plot?
Well, technically, the Elder Wand is integral, but it feels like a cheap cop out because she pulls it out of nowhere.
Yeah. And the invisibility cloak is just like, oh, see, this is more important than you thought it was. Kind of. Not really.
It still does the same thing it did before, but it's like, now it has a special name. And then,
what was the other thing? The gem?
That's like, the Resurrection Stone.
Oh, was that? Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I was assuming, like, when they brought up the stone again. I was like, I'm guessing it's one of those things.
So as someone who didn't read the books, because this was messy in the books too, that whole sequence where he, like, breathes on it and then drops it in the Forbidden Forest and then doesn't get killed. Like, he dies but then comes back to life.
Yeah.
That must have been... I mean, it was confusing for me. I was like, oh, yeah.
I still don't remember. Did he live because of the Resurrection Stone, or just because of some like technicality in the Horcrux rules?
I thought
it was like it. I assumed that he lived because of the Resurrection Stone, and he left it in the forest, so it was still a lot. Like,
oh, wasn't it some really bullshit thing where it's like, oh, Voldemort? It's like Harry has like a shield. So yeah. If anyone tries to kill him...
I think in the book that's what it was, yeah. Which made no sense.
If anyone tries to kill him, they kill the part of Voldemort that's inside of him instead of him. So he kind of has, like, an extra life, basically.
Yeah. Scott Pilgrim.
Except he's had an extra life for the entire story. So she's like, oh, here he has one more extra life.
So she's like... So effectively, he was never really in any danger.
Yeah. Well, I kind of like that, actually, in the end, he kind of becomes like his end game. Like, this is how I saw it, was that in the end game, when they come back for the final battle, basically he becomes the bait to bait off Voldemort, so Ron and Hermione can just kill the snake.
Yeah, that was kind of cool.
Yeah,
I thought that was if that was how they planned it. That's the idea I got. I was like, oh, that's pretty. That's a lot better than what I thought I was going to have, which was a Dragon Ball Z-esque showdown with wands. And
yeah. Well,
correct me if I'm wrong, Zach. Didn't Harry still have to kill Voldemort in the book after Nagini was dead?
I think so, because there was
turned him into a mortal guy who could be killed.
Right, yeah, it made him mortal. In the book, it's this absolutely hideous, again, 40-page info dump where Harry and Voldemort are literally circling each other with wands pointed at each other and just explaining shit to each other and sort of being smug and gloaty about who's going to die and who's not going to die. And I was that's one sequence I thought was vastly improved in the film, especially the bit with Neville.
So good.
It was good. It was really good. It was really effective. It worked out really well. And in the books, Voldemort, like, smashes the sorting hat on Neville's head and lights it on fire.
That's right.
Which is so stupid. Like, and he, like, he somehow leaps out of the hat and, like, Voldemort's carrying that snake around in the book in this, like, sparkly,
shield.
Yeah, oh, man. All this, honestly, like, this movie was really good, but it did remind me of just how stupid the ending of the book was. But overall, the movie, yeah, I really enjoyed it. Emotionally satisfying, but it's such a clunky... it's clunkily constructed ending that they
it's
just
all over the place.
They just really couldn't escape it. And one thing in the movie I thought that was much weaker, the supporting cast, a lot of them die.
That was my big thing, Rene Lupin, is that his name?
Yeah. Lupin and Tonks.
Like,
Lupin
he's like easily my favorite like side character teacher that he had, and he just kind of dies off screen. Like, he And
that was the same in the books too, actually. He just walks in and finds them dead.
Yeah, they're dead, and it's literally like a few chapters earlier, he and Tonks just announced they had a kid. And it
was like a Yoshiyuki Tomino, like, now you're totally gonna die moment.
Yeah, right. That's good. That's a good point. But it felt like emotional pornography. Like, look at how sad
which is what J.K. Rowling does best.
There you go, yeah. But the other thing that really suffered was the Bellatrix Lestrange.
Yeah, the weird dissolving in midair thing.
Well, not just that, but that felt so just tacked in. Like, I remember when this happens in the book. Here it is. There you go. Moving on.
Yeah, she just kind of shows up, and then they say the word bitch, and then they kill her. I'm like, oh, okay.
That's all anyone was waiting for, yeah.
I'll be honest. I cheered when she said that. It's hard not to.
Again, emotionally satisfying, but just felt a little, like, thrown in, because they knew it had to be in there. If it wasn't in there, the fans would lose their shit. So
I was really disappointed. I think they actually skipped the I think Percy dies in the book, right? Percy Weasley.
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
And they skipped it, and I thought his death was really cool because he says a joke, and like Fred or George is like, whoa, Percy said a joke. He doesn't have a sense of humor, and it's like this funny moment, and then he dies, and I thought that was like a really good moment of kind of juxtaposing how the Weasley twins can be really silly and how people are actually dying.
Yeah, but he's not a character in the films, like, at all.
Exactly. Yeah, he shows up, I think, in, like, what's the last time we saw him, like, with a speaking role? Had to have been, like, the fifth movie?
It had to have been the fifth, because he was a Jack Holder in the whole...
Oh, that's right.
What's-her-face thing.
Umbridge.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. All I can think of is, it's Imelda Staunton. That's all. I can't think of the character's name, but the actress I recognize. So they kill off instead. Well, I think he dies in the book too, but like
he does.
Is it Fred or George?
Whichever one. There's less than 50% of the Weasley twins left at the end.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's a good way. A good way of putting it. How did you guys feel about the? I have to admit, I got a big smile on my face in the Chamber Secrets thing. I thought that was actually pretty well.
Yeah, that was my. That was. I thought that was a really great character moment because it kind of just pays off everything between those two
with Ron and Hermione.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was really well done.
That didn't happen in the book, I don't think, and that was good. That was like kind of this moment of like letting go of the tension that's been in the story, and I thought that worked really well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although in the books and in the movies, I never understood the Ginny thing.
Ginny is no. Like, Ginny is a piece of paper with a face drawn onto her.
Yeah. No, there's no like I do not care about Harry Potter's romantic. I cared about it in the movies and in the books when he was being an asshole teenager about it and just being kind of whiny and pouty, and difficult with all that stuff. But the minute he's just like, okay, Ginny, now you're my girlfriend.
Yeah, Ginny is like it's too perfectly wrapped up.
Yeah, there's never any conflict between the two. Not that there's time for it. But, yeah. I don't know. How did you feel about the whole Gringotts sequence?
I only saw a part of that, so I probably can't comment on it because I came in late for the movie.
Okay, did you see the dragon?
Was that the beginning part with the goblins and
stuff?
Yeah,
the very beginning.
I still didn't understand where that goblin came from exactly.
he showed up at the end of the first half of the story.
Yeah, he rescued him from Bellatrix. I remember that.
Yeah.
But I don't remember like if he was a good guy or a bad guy when I came into this. And then I was like, oh, okay, well, this is cool. And the dragon sequence was pretty cool. I liked that a lot.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah, the goblin is just kind of this recalcitrant sort of asshole who... He'll help them in exchange for getting, I guess, goblins really want their goblin steel forged artifacts back in their own possession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he's kind of their hostage, or he's sort of holding them hostage, and that's why he helps them out. But
question I had was the sword just kind of disappears and then shows up at the end of the movie.
It was a fake sword, right? Harry gave him a fake one?
None of that was clear.
Understand it at all. I was like, wait a minute, so which one's fake and which one's real? And they talked about multiple swords, and I was like, okay, I don't understand this. But I'm just going to let that go as a dragon is flying right now.
Yeah, that whole bit was just like, wait, which one's fake, which one's real, why is any of this important? And it's also super convenient that all of those artifacts happen to be Horcruxes, and they're all just sitting around in Hogwarts. I think
the dragon is a really good example of what I think is like the strong point of the book and the movie is like, and when I read the book, I was like, this is going to be a great action movie I read it, but it's like, this is a terrible plot, but it's going to be a great action movie. And the dragon is such a good example of like, she just went all out with that. And it's really cool to see that in a movie where it's like, okay, they've been like solving mysteries in Hogwarts, but now they're going to bust out of Gringotts with a dragon.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the dragon sequence is really well done, and specifically I just like the way that it looked and the way that they sort of executed that whole thing, because in the books, Hermione is kind of this character who's always sort of concerned about the welfare of magical creatures, like the house elf thing in the third book that I'm glad they cut. Yeah. I'm glad they cut all that shit, because it's chaff. But it's an interesting character moment, and in the movie we finally see that side of her character with the dragon, where, you know, they're basically abusing the shit out of this thing, and she calls them barbarians for it, and the thing's really beat to shit, like, it's in bad shape, and they show all that, and that's cool, interesting fantasy stuff, and I liked that.
Mm.
Yeah, they set it up really well and very quickly, and I think they pulled, I give all the credit to Yates for pulling that off, because that could have came off incredibly dumb. When I look back at it, I'm like, man... You know, if somebody with lesser hands, I could see this being really stupid. But I went with it, so, for them.
That's the whole thing, though. Like, reading that book, you're like, oh my god, this is going to be a really stupid movie. Like, holy cow, it just all explodes at the end. It's like, what the fuck? But, yeah, they did as, I think it was as good as it possibly could have been.
Yeah. I think there were things that I would have actually liked Yates to have, like, radically changed, but then people would have, like, burned down his house for doing it. Like, yeah. I think the way J.K. Rowling just crucifies all the Slytherins is really stupid, and I kind of wanted Yates to fix that, but I didn't really expect him to.
Yeah, I guess so. That's barely in the movie, though. I mean, they take the Slytherins down to the dungeon, I guess. Not that any of those kids had actively made the choice to become fascist,
right?
Nazis like you know, Voldemort and his crew. You know, they're Nazis, basically.
Corey, I want to ask you a question, actually. When McGonagall says to take them to the dungeons, what did you take that to mean?
I found that to be very thinly veiled Nazi, like, in concentration. Because I felt like, I'm like, oh, man, that's kind of harsh for these kids that didn't really do anything wrong. I mean, they weren't actively fighting against Hogwarts or even within this war. And I was like, But then,
I had a conversation after the movie with my girlfriend about this, and she said that that was supposed to be the Slytherin dormitory, which is in the dungeons. And I was like, I don't think someone who hasn't read the book is going to know that's what that means.
Yeah. Really? Oh, okay. Like, I'm like, man, that's really mean.
I've read the books, and when I saw that, I thought that she was taking them to a dungeon. So I'm not even sure what they were intending that to mean.
Yeah, because when they said dungeon, I thought, man, they're going to lock them up and throw away the key for quite a bit. I was like, damn.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I don't know. I think as the second half of a movie, like these, I think they're going to work really well as one film. My favorite of the series is still Goblet of Fire. I think it just works the best as
That's
a standalone.
That's my favorite, too.
Right, as a standalone story and as an action movie, that one's my favorite. It's the most complete, I think, standalone.
Well, it has a very strong structure, like, just inside of it, with the Triwizard Cup.
Yeah.
With the three-act kind of way it goes. And that's actually my favorite, too. And then the next one that I liked was the third one.
Yeah.
And which felt very...
That's where they switched it up. Like, they kind of changed all that Chris Columbus really, like, cheesy kids movie stuff.
Man, when's the last time either of you saw those first two?
I've seen them on TV a couple times recently, but not in full.
I rewatched them a couple of years ago. I couldn't get through them.
Columbus, so. Man, that first one especially, it's just like a clip show of like, remember the book?
Yeah, right.
But I have to admit that at the end of this movie, the thing that got me a little sniffly was when Hagrid comes up at the very end of the movie and hugs Harry. Like, that was like a touchstone for me. For some reason, that image sums up a big emotional core of the book. I don't know why. Just like,
because Harry spends so much time with Hagrid, and he really is like probably the most important faculty member at Hogwarts other than Dumbledore.
Right, yeah.
Even more so than Dumbledore.
It was a nice little emotional moment at the very end that kind of gave me what I wanted out of the end of this. That kind of summed up a lot of it for me. I don't know. I saw this thing at 3 o'clock in the morning, because I was awake and they were doing 3 a.m.s, and I had a friend who saw the midnight and was like, I'm going to see it again. You want to come? I was like, yes. It was kind of full. Like at 3 o'clock in the morning, it was kind of full at the theater.
Oh, it was packed, matinee this morning.
Yeah. Well, you know, you don't make $180 million in 3 days without anyone showing up.
Yeah.
All right. Well, final thoughts, anything?
Oh, are we not going to mention the epilogue, at least, like...
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask about that.
Okay, sure. Well, that's a good place to end.
Was that really how it ended?
Like,
yes.
That was 100% accurate, unfortunately.
Oh, my God. I was like, this is awful. This is weird. This that feels like that bad Matrix Revolutions epilogue. Yeah. I was just like,
It is the worst. I think it's about 7 pages. It is the worst 7 pages in the entire Harry Potter book series, I think.
Yeah. Could have just been 1 page that said, and then they all got married. Who got married? Exactly who you think will get married. And they all had kids. And
then Draco shows up
19 years later, nobody met anyone new.
Yeah.
And they're all it's all these 20-year-old kid actors with just like wigs and crow's feet makeup.
Except for Emma Watson, who looks exactly the same. She has no makeup on.
20 years later, it's just nothing. And it's
a non-aging charm on herself.
that whole sequence, I was waiting for that. I'm like, all right, here we go, 19 years later. And it was kind of worse than I thought it was going to be, because I figured they would at least make it a little bit more subtle. Like, I understand they're trying to show you that 20 years later, the wizarding society still exists and Hogwarts is back on its feet and everything's back to normal. I get that. It also leaves it open for a sequel. But he literally gets down on his knee in front of his kid and is like, Albus Severus Potter.
I can't stand it.
I broke out laughing. I was the only one laughing at that time, and I felt very awkward.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
I'm like, that kid's going to have serious therapy bills when he grows up.
Well, it's this super ham-fisted, like, I've named you after the two most important people, and
the most important people in my life, not in Ginny's life, because she apparently doesn't get a say in these people's names.
Well, whatever, she's a Weasley. But, like, and then he's like, the last line of the movie is, like, you know, the sorting hat takes your like, he explains the sorting hat to this kid, very sort of matter-of-factly, and that's it. That's the last line in this 20 hours of films. Oh gosh! That did not work.
I was laughing.
I believe he left out the reference to Neville being the herbology teacher.
Oh yeah,
which is at least one stupid thing that was left out of that epilogue.
I mean, that stuff is necessarily not stupid, but do a sequel some 10 years from now and cram all that information in. Then you don't need to put it at the end of your epic story. Oh, by the way, here's what happened to everyone.
Yeah, Malfoy is happily married. God.
What happened with him? Like, I don't understand. Like, okay, so he turns to the dark side yet again at the end, and he just walks off, and then he's completely okay and fine and well-adjusted.
He's like, peace, bro. I orchestrated the murder of Dumbledore, but whatever, I'm forgiven.
Well, yeah. he basically decides not to... okay, so he saves... Harry Potter saves him in the Room of Requirement, when it's all burning down. He saves his life.
Yeah.
So then I guess the Malfoys at this point seem to have started regretting being Nazis. So at the end of the movie, he basically joins Voldemort, but then they just take off. Like they're done.
I thought their arc ends just so horribly in the book and the movie. I never felt satisfied with them.
Yeah, I
had no idea what was going on. I was like, okay, so he's gonna do something here, and then he just walks off.
They don't do anything in the books either. Like the Malfoys just don't. The one thing is like Narcissa, kind of like she helps Harry and a little bit, kind of passive aggressively, and then that's it. They don't really do anything.
Yeah, well, she's the one that picks him up. She's the one that claims he's dead, and he's clearly not, right?
Right.
Okay, so, yeah, I guess, like, does she know that he saved Draco at that point?
She doesn't
know that at all, because Draco was still in Hogwarts, and they were in the forest. And then he finally rejoins them when Voldemort says, come and join us.
She knows, Harry tells her that Draco's alive, but he doesn't say that that... he saved Draco or anything.
Oh, okay.
When did that happen? Did that happen in the movie?
Yeah, because...
When did he say it, or when did he save Draco?
When did he say that?
He didn't say it. He nodded his head very, very lightly so that nobody else would see. And it's when she's, like, crouched over him. She's like, is Draco still alive? And he nods his head, like, the tiniest.
Oh, is that what she said something there? I must have missed that, because I was just like... he looks alive, and she just said he's dead. Okay.
Yeah, right. That entire plot revolves around Voldemort not checking Harry's pulse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was like, this is an egregious overlook, Voldemort.
Yeah. That's like, the greatest plan.
Your plan is a little flawed here.
He doesn't want to touch him. He'll get all dirty. Harry's got cooties.
All right, guys. Okay, well, that was great. Thanks for the Potter chat.
Yeah, sure.
And no, all right, guys. Well, thanks a lot.
Hey.
All right.
Okay, joining me next, who is at a convention right now, convention staffer Steph. Hey, Steph.
Hey.
Thanks for coming on this extremely short notice call out show. I really appreciate it. So
no problem.
You just told me a few minutes ago you are at a show right now.
Yeah, I am here right now. I've been here pretty much since Thursday night doing setup and basically the whole weekend working registration just right at the front of the con. I'm one of the first people you see when you come in, so that's kind of cool.
And so this is in Winnipeg?
Yeah, it's in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
Okay, all right. So how long have you been a convention staffer?
I've been a convention staffer for ICON. This is actually my first year on staff for ICON. But I've been on staff for another convention in the city, ChibiCon. I think I started there in 2004. So I was with ChibiCon 2004 to, I think, 2008. And then I took a little break from staffing conventions, and now I'm back at ICON, which is the bigger of the two conventions in the city.
What? Why do you do it, I guess? What's the satisfaction in this for you?
I find it really fun. When I first started with ChibiCon, it was because I was in the club that ran that convention. So when you were like tight-knit in that club, you didn't really have a choice. Like, you were on staff ran the convention. Mm-hmm. So that's where I kind of got a taste for it. And since, you know, just differences happened, I decided to come back on ICON because I missed staffing a convention. I missed being part of making that weekend happen, and I remember what it was like to live in a city and be an anime fan and not have anywhere to go and not have anyone who shares your interests. And I remember the first time I went to a convention just as an attendee, one of the first ones we had in the city, and I was just like blown away that there was actually somebody else who shared the same weird interest as me. So I want to, if I can make that happen for some other people who think that nobody else in the city likes this kind of stuff, then it's worth it.
What's your attendance like at this show right now?
I think it's over 2,000 right now. So it's not huge, but it's big for our city.
Yeah. For a single city convention, I would imagine you don't get a lot of like travelers to that show.
I think we get some from Saskatchewan and like the smaller cities in the province, but we don't get very many other travelers. Like, I think it's mostly just from the province over.
All right, so it's local con, and that's pretty good for local con.
Yeah.
So you're handling registration. So tell us a little bit about the headaches involved and how early you got to get started. Like, what's that like?
Well, we opened the doors at noon on Friday, and I had to be there, I think, around 7, just making sure passes were numbered, making sure we had enough forms, making sure everything was set up so that when we opened those doors, people could get in very quickly and get moving into the actual convention, because nobody likes to wait in line. And we had people actually lined up at the doors to get in before I got there, and I got there at 7:30. On Friday morning, and there were people who were there before me, and I was like, what are you guys doing? You know, if I wasn't on staff, I'd be at home sleeping. But there's very dedicated people who really like to wait in that line, and they like to be first in. So that's cool. I'm glad that we have people who enjoy the convention that much that they'll wait. So, yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. No, it's kind of an anticipation thing where you're sitting around with your friends like, yeah, can't wait for the anime convention. Well, what are we going to do? We can sit in our apartment and stare at the walls until it's time to leave, or we can just go sit in line now. Like,
Yeah, exactly.
I can see it, you know?
Yeah.
So as a staffer, what are some, like, okay, so you've got to deal with a bunch of volunteers. And you mentioned you're a supervisor, so that means you're in a management position.
Yeah.
Doing this over the years, was this your first time as a supervisor position?
No, I was registration at ChibiCon, too. So.
Okay, so were you into...
It was the same position in both conventions, just this one significantly larger. ChibiCon was only about 400 attendees. Like, it's Chibi, right? It's small convention.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So the name is apropos. Were you sort of a natural manager of people? Because I know convention management, it's a lot of people who, I mean, not to blanket this or anything, but at a lot of cons, the management is not necessarily actually experienced in management. And managing people is really difficult. That's a skill set that people pay money for.
Absolutely.
So were you into that beforehand?
I like to think I'm not bad at it. I try to be nice to the volunteers. I try to explain everything clearly when they don't understand something or if they need help with something or just, you know, if it's their first time working at the reg desk, you know, it can be intimidating sitting behind that desk and people coming up to you and asking you questions and expecting you to know the answer right away. So I like to, you know, I try to keep it chill behind the reg desk and, you know, keep it calm. You know, it's okay. They can wait a couple seconds while you look for the answer to their question. But, I like to think that I'm pretty nice to the volunteers. But so far, the volunteers we've had at this convention have been great. Everyone's been really eager to learn and really quick to pick up the registration process here. We go through Ticketmaster, so it's pretty easy our end. We just kind of take the ticket stub, and we have them fill out their name and phone number in case they lose their badge, and we file it away and give them their pass, and they're done. So it's pretty easy, but the reg desk here gets a lot of questions like, I lost my pass, where's bag check, what's going on right now, you know, can you help me with the scavenger hunt? I got a lot of that this weekend.
Well, that's, I guess that's to be expected.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially for a local con like that, they probably just find, you know, grab the first staffer they could find and
For sure.
Ask away. Do you actually get to enjoy the convention, or are you sitting in con ops or the registration desk all weekend?
Well, I sat at the registration desk for most of the weekend so far, but I've gone off and gone to a couple panels that I've been interested in. But for the most part, you know, part of the reason I came on ICON staff is because last year ICON, most of my friends were on the staff, and I felt like I didn't have anything to do ever because every one of my friends were on the staff. So I was like, what am I going to do here? Everyone's on staff and I have nothing to do. So I thought, you know, if I was on staff, I would have something to do. And now I do. And it's awesome. So.
Right. So you're just hanging out with your friends and, by the way, running a convention.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the best part about it.
That's cool. What kind of guests are... Do you guys have guests at ICON?
We've got four. We've got Greg Ayers, Johnny Young Bosch, Chris Sabat, and Eric Vail this weekend. So it's our 10-year anniversary, so we brought in a couple extra guests that we usually do. I think we usually only have, like, two or three at most. We've had four before, but, yeah, we definitely kind of went all out with the guests. We had Greg Ayers before. He's a con regular, actually. We bring him in all the time. The attendees just love him. He's very personable. So, yeah, we just love having him. We had Johnny Young Bosch before, and we brought Chris and Eric. They're new. So some old, some new, to commemorate having 10 years.
Well, that's cool. I can't imagine, like, it must be kind of tough to book guests for a convention in Winnipeg. I don't know. Does that offer any special challenges?
I don't personally work with really booking the guests, but I know it's easy for us to get Greg here because he's said that he likes coming here, so it's easy for us to get him here. I think it was difficult to get people in the first year, in 2007, that we really had industry guests. We had Greg and Vic, and I think they were difficult to get, like, to bring in because it was all new for us. Mm-hmm. But once they came to the convention and Greg, he really enjoyed himself. So I think that he said that he was going to talk it up to Johnny. And then we brought in Johnny and Chris Ayers the following year. And since then, it's gotten easier and easier as we build up more of a network with people in the industry. So.
Right. Okay, cool. So let's talk a little bit about convention culture, because you mentioned that, you know, you've noticed as a fan the culture changing over the last half a decade. And because you're in Manitoba, and I can, you know, I've had my own pet theories about American fans of, you know, East Coast versus West Coast. That's kind of my pet theory. But I'm super curious, like, how has it changed up there?
My first convention I went to was called Summerfest, and it was like before ICON was ICON. They had this thing called Summerfest, and it was just one of the clubs put it on. And I was 14 years old, I think. Yeah. And I was just, I think there were 200 people there. It was small, and it was at a university. And it was a lot of people who were a lot older than I was. There were some girls my own age, but for the most part, it was like guys in their late 20s, like college guys who were into this stuff and who had probably gotten into it, I would think, in the 80s with like Robotech and that kind of thing that was popular back then.
Right, the Laserdisc set, yeah.
Yeah, and so it was all those kind of people. And so as I started going to more and more conventions, like the next year after that was the first ICON, it became a lot more of teenagers who were really into it, and that was a little bit before the boom. And then once like Naruto and Bleach and Full Metal Alchemist came out, like I noticed that it completely changed from those older fans. They weren't even at conventions anymore, or if they were, they were looked at as like the creepy guys, and well, all the teenagers were running around on their sugar rush from Pocky or whatever, I don't know. And I was 14, 15 when I started, but because I started back in 2001, I think that was before that whole let's be loud all weekend culture really started. So don't get me wrong, we were loud. Actually, at the first ICON, my friends and I, we were so loud that the convention one of the convention staffers actually got the university to give them another room to shove us into so we would be away from everybody else. And he's actually the conteur now. And I asked him, do you remember that? Because that was me. And he's like, oh, yes, the loud girls in the corner. So that was pretty funny.
Wow.
But, yeah. Yeah, so it's definitely changed. So I was around 19 or 20 when it became Teenage Party Weekend, as you call it. And I found it kind of fun at first, but it got old really, really fast for me. And so by then I was already on staff for ChibiCon, so I could step away pretty easily and go, you know, to the staff room or to my hotel room and take a little break and, you know, chill out for a minute.
I'd probably be really awful at managing con attendees because my patience for it, like somebody just being obnoxious just to be obnoxious, like, oh man.
Yeah.
And I understand, like, I get it. Like, you put a bunch of hyperactive teenagers in a room together and it's going to be annoying.
Yeah, exactly.
But I don't understand, like, so are they not irritated with each other?
I don't know, because definitely when I was 14 and I had a couple of girlfriends who were like, I'm not a very loud person, honestly. I'm a little bit quiet, I'm a little bit shy, not too much, but just enough to keep me reserved enough at these conventions, which is why I actually like to do Reg, because it gets me out of my box and gets me talking to people. But I had friends who were definitely like that, loud and, you know, irritating, and I was a little bit part of it, but sometimes I would just, you know, need a break from them. Even when I was that age too, because I would get irritated with it and feel embarrassed at times.
I remember, you know, as a teenager I certainly had loud, annoying friends, and I was never really, like, I was never that guy. It always made me really uncomfortable that they were just being so obnoxious. And I didn't go to my first anime convention until I was, 19 maybe? So I wasn't quite in college. It was my last year of high school. But I was sort of past the super loud, annoying teenager phase that I think a lot of people go through. You know, cons were a lot more mellow back then, so it was a very different experience. Yeah. But aside from, you know, annoying con attendees, what's the culture like in terms of, okay, this is an anime convention and 50% of the panels are zombie ninja steampunk whatever the fuck, like, is that what you guys have up there?
Well, you know what, at this particular convention we don't get a lot of that. We actually don't have a lot of panels, which is unfortunate. We just can't get people to come in and run them. Like, we have a lot of panels done by the guests, and we have some done by the local Japanese cultural center. They do a sushi making and a tea ceremony and those kinds of things, but it's hard to get fans to run panels at this convention. I think we only had 2 or 3, so we don't get a lot of the zombie ninja, you know, weird ones that I've seen, like at Anime North. Those kinds of ones. So, you know, it's a good thing and it's a bad thing, because, you know, we don't get those ones that are off topic and are just craziness. But we also don't get a lot of panels, which is, I think it's unfortunate. We have a lot more showing rooms and a lot less panels. And I feel like our convention could actually benefit from having more fan-run panels. And I wish that more people would want to run them.
What is the chief activity then? Is that, what do people really show up for? Is it just the guests, or do like a lot of people fill up the viewing rooms?
It's the cosplay. Definitely. Okay. Cosplay always goes to capacity.
Yeah.
Always. We got the dance. Actually, this year our dance is DJed by Greg, and it was last year too, and it was awesome. So that's one of the big selling points. And it's really the guests, I think, that bring people in. And I think it's a lot of, since Winnipeg, the community here is so small that, you know, the anime fans, they come to ICON because that's their thing that they do to see all their friends once a year in the summertime. They chat up on the forums. Like, our forums are active year round with everyone who comes to the convention. So it's just, they come to ICON and they hang out in the hall. We have a lot of people who just hang out in the hall. And, you know, we've got rooms open for people to play Yu-Gi-Oh cards or Magic cards or whatever they want. And we have a lot of, like, our dealer's room is obviously always packed, as it is at most cons, I'm sure. But I think it's usually the guests that really draw the crowd.
Interesting. Okay. Well, yeah, because I've never been to a convention where the focus wasn't the panel programming. Like, it's every convention I go to, you are sitting in a room watching people talk about something. And I like the experience of a non-panel driven convention is alien to me. So that's,
yeah,
that's interesting. But that must mean your average attendance, the age of your average attendee must be fairly low.
I think it's around 16, 17, but okay. I've noticed it's been getting a little bit older, as I guess we're not really getting any new anime fans, so it's a lot of the same people, and they just get older. They don't necessarily get a lot quieter, but they get older. Yeah, but it was a shock to me kind of when I went to Anime North a few years ago, and that was my first really, or my only really big convention, and I looked at their programming, and I was like, oh my god, panels, this is cool, like I want to go to all of these things, because we just don't really have that here that much. I mean, we do have some, but not nearly as much as Anime North. And then, you know, I listen to Ancast a lot, so when you guys do your Anime Expo or talk about San Diego Comic Con, I'm like, oh, I want to go to all these cool panels, that sounds really interesting. So, you know, I really wish we had more here.
Okay, well, would you ever consider, I don't know what kind of a commute Anime North is for you, but I mean, would you ever consider jumping into that pond and volunteering there?
Well, Anime North is, like, it's a hour and a half flight for me to get to Toronto. So I thought about volunteering the second year we went, but then I figured I just kind of wanted to go and enjoy the convention and, you know, do whatever I wanted. But, you know, I would certainly think about volunteering or staffing a bigger con if I lived closer. But since it's such a trek for me to get anywhere, I would think, you know, I kind of just want to go to panels and dealer's room and enjoy it as much as I can, since I have to pay a lot to get there.
Yeah, that's interesting. Those are two different experiences, you know, and one, as a staffer, you're staffing for very specific reasons, because that's the fun thing at that show for you. Like, you can sit around and chat with your friends and, you know, deal with, you know, running registration, which can be, you know, that stuff can be a lot of fun. But then when you go to, like, at a bigger show, you just want to experience the show itself. Like, you don't really want to be stuck in the panel, or you don't really want to be stuck in the registration desk all weekend at something like Anime North. So that's interesting.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks for coming on and sharing your stories with us. That's fascinating.
Thanks for having me.
Sure, and I hope the rest of the convention goes really well for you.
Thanks.
Okay, well, take care.
Yeah, you too. Thanks a lot.
Okay, up next we are talking to Christian, who is actually a returning champion on the Callout shows. Hey, Christian.
Hi. How you doing?
I'm pretty good. What's on your mind, buddy?
Well, I wanted to talk about Makoto Shinkai, who is personally my favorite director of anime right now, even more so than Miyazaki, although it did take a little while for me to really ultimately decide that I did actually like Shinkai's movies a little more than Miyazaki's, although of course Miyazaki is one of the masters, but I decided that ultimately I just felt more attracted towards Shinkai's movies. And what I want to ask is, when Justin was still on the show, the two of you would mention Shinkai occasionally in passing, and I sort of got the impression that your guys' opinion of him and his movies sort of iffy, but you guys didn't necessarily not like them, but you guys wouldn't say everything that you seemed you wanted to say. So I was interested in finding out what your ultimate opinion is.
Well, Justin is still on this show, just not all the time. We have him on. He comes on when he feels like it and when the situation calls for it. So Justin's still on this show. But as for Shinkai, I respect him a lot more than I enjoy his work. I don't find his films to be particularly entertaining or enjoyable. And I hate to say this, I feel like he's kind of a one-trick pony. He's got one movie in him that he keeps making over and over and over again. And his style lends itself to being, you know, just repeated over and over again, to the point where I got through about half of 5 centimeters per second and just shut it off, because I didn't care, and it was just so slow. And yes, I've seen a slow pan across a sunset with crickets chirping. I've seen it. You know, I don't need more of this. But I respect his craftsman. Like, as a craftsman, he knows what he's doing. He's really talented and accomplished artist, but it's kind of like the painter that you respect and admire, but don't personally really love his work. That's kind of my take on Shinkai. I wish he would change it up a little bit and make something that wasn't soaked in this kind of nostalgia that kind of just drives me a little crazy. It's like, all right, dude, we get it. You like the sound of the subway car and the, you know, the sunset and the wheat field. You know, all right, show us something new. But that's kind of unfortunately, Justin's not here, so he can't really offer his opinion. But I know he likes Shinkai's stuff more than I do, but I know he's also not a super fan. So that's kind of my take on it. I know that that's not, I guess that's not really a very common opinion of his. I think he's kind of either you think he's a genius and love everything he's ever done, or you've never seen what he does. So maybe I'm in a minority. I don't know.
Well, I get what you're saying, because I look at his movies, and honestly, as much as I do really love his stuff, when I first popped in 5 centimeters per second, I'd really wanted to see it for a long time. But the thing was, is that when I finally found it at a Best Buy in the anime section, although it's the anime section in Best Buy's now are more like a wart on
shelf.
Best Buy or something. Yeah, it's just this little almost kiosk of just anime. But I saw it there, and I was really excited that there was like 3 copies left or something stacked sideways. So I was like, all right, I finally found it and I can get to see it. And when I got home and I popped it in, I sort of had this feeling in my head like, okay, I pretty much know what is going to come. So there was sort of a sense of dread almost, because I knew what I was in for. And because of that, I was a little bit of my excitement had dwindled. But at the same time, I also know that what I'm expecting is also what I want to see. And the thing that draws me into Shinkai's movies really is that, I mean, first of all, his backgrounds and scenery are simply gorgeous to to look at. And a lot of times when he has sort of 2 different backgrounds and sceneries, there's the natural kind where it's, you know, it's showing fields or a landscape and the sky, and the scenery feels very open and very reminiscent, I guess, of what I would always see growing up in Hawaii, these vast fields of sugarcane, and you could see the sky going on forever and the wind is always blowing. And so I guess that's maybe what maybe draws me to Shinkai, is this sort of, I guess, connection I can create with these movies. But back to what I was saying is I knew what I was getting in for, but that's also what I wanted. And I know that in terms of actual characters in Shinkai's movies, there really aren't actual, the characters don't even actually have character, really. They're sort of, to me, they feel like these vessels for the emotions that they're supposed to feeling. And it's, yes, I admit it's very, it can get very melodramatic, and it's, at times it can get cheesy, and you know that Shinkai is really, really trying to tug at your heartstrings. But the thing that makes, I feel that the thing that makes him separate from another director or another show or another movie that you can really tell they're trying to tug on your heartstrings, and instead of rolling your eyes at him, you may actually feel a genuine emotion, is that, again, his scenery. I feel that his sceneries lend very much to the drama that is happening on camera, such as the lighting, the shadows. Sometimes the scenery can actually look very almost fantasy-like in how pristine and how and how poetic it looks, because I've never seen skies look quite like they do in Shinkai's movies. But I feel that the sceneries lend so much to the emotion that it gives it that little extra push beyond just being needlessly melodramatic.
Right. Excuse me. Right. So you're saying basically that the craftsmanship and the artistry kind of makes up for the fact that the rest of it is kind of this melodramatic thing that where the characters aren't really characters. They're just sort of all they sort of do is deliver these emotions that he wants to see, you know, on screen. They're not people you necessarily like are rooting for or are interested in their character arc. Yeah, I would agree with that. Although I don't think those two things together necessarily make something that is I even really find compelling or entertaining. I don't think I've ever gotten through one of his movies in a single sitting. I know I fell asleep during Place Promised in our early days a couple of times. It took me a while to get through that, and at the end of it, I was like, why did I get through that whole thing? And it's weird because this is one of these guys where it's like, I know he's tremendously talented. I know he knows what he's doing. I know he's like creating these works of art that are appreciated by, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. And just the experience of sitting through one of his movies is just not enjoyable for me. I feel like he's taking the schmaltziest and most emotionally manipulative parts of what Miyazaki does and just sort of expanding those out to the macro towards the entire film.
Right.
So that's, I mean, yeah, that's, and it's tough when you have a relationship with an artist like that. It's like, wow, you really know what you're doing, but man, I don't like what you're doing. Which is, you know, that kind of sucks. But then again, you know, if you spend a lot of time thinking about art and how you feel about it and your favorites and your least favorites, I mean, that's kind of that's an easy conclusion to come to where, you know, you respect a guy, but not for me. But that, so you've sort of determined that after all this, like, this is totally your thing, and this guy is your all-time favorite anime director.
Yeah, I find it funny that it took you several attempts to just get through Promised Place in just once, whereas that I have actually ranked that as my favorite anime of all time.
Huh,
anime, okay. Anime show or movie otherwise. I've actually I gotta ask, how many times do you think it actually took you to get through that movie once?
Well, I was invited to a theatrical premiere, which I fell asleep in. And once mm-hmm. I fell asleep in like, it was like 15 minutes. And it was late at night, so.
Right.
And it was in New York City, and I knew I had to drive home. And there were a couple of other factors in there. I didn't really want to be there. So I fell asleep that time and missed it. And then I got the DVD, and I got through that. I got through about an hour before I fell asleep. So I, maybe three times, took me three tries to get through it. I don't know why I didn't stop, but yeah, it took me three tries. I guess there was something about it that was compelling enough to keep me going, but I think I had to write an article on it or something, but yeah.
So it took you three tries to get through that movie. I've actually probably seen that movie at least maybe eight times.
I would have to say. Well, different strokes, you know, it's not, I don't think there's anything wrong with you. I'm just saying, like, it's not for me.
And the thing about it is that, like, I'm not going to say the movie is for everyone, obviously, because things get pretty convoluted in that movie towards the about three-fourths of the way through, so much so that even I, after seeing it about eight times, am still sort of lost on the whole dreams and the astral quantum physics that I'm not even sure if Shinkai is really basing it on actual data and actual physics, or if he's just making a lot of this shit up as he goes along.
Yeah.
But the thing is that movie was actually the first movie to ever make me actually cry.
Wow.
And it wasn't even during like the first couple of times. I think it was the fifth time that I watched it, right at the end, right before the credits rolled, one tear just sort of
how poetic. Well, that's interesting. So you have a fairly complicated relationship with these films, and it sounds like your appreciation and understanding of them changes over time, changes over the number of times you've seen them. I mean, do you feel like you're sort of inexplicably drawn to his stuff?
I think so. I remember seeing Promised Place a lot in my library, and I sort of passed it by a couple of times. I didn't actually really have any interest in seeing it, but then one day I really looked at the cover, and I really looked at the title, and I think the title is probably what really drew me in. And so I picked it up. I looked on the back, read the synopsis, and then I also read, I don't know who it was, but somebody said, Shinkai, of course, this has been thrown around a lot, but that he's like the next Miyazaki, which I do not think he is, but that got my attention. So I was like, oh, the next Miyazaki. Well, I'll see about that. So I took it home and I watched it. And I, of course, it's aesthetically a gorgeous movie. And so that was the hook for me. It's as superficial as that sounds, I was just really drawn in by the artistry. And then I don't really know, but I think the story of like these three kids just getting together and building an airplane because they wanted to fly away somewhere. I don't know. That seems to really strike a chord with me in terms of I'm not even sure. I tried to think of really eloquent reason for why I'm drawn to Shinkai as much as I am, and before I came on here, and honestly, I don't really know if I can come up with that satisfactory of a reason. I feel that I'm just really, really drawn to it. Promised Place in particular.
Well, that's I don't think that's necessarily out of line with the way he makes his films, with the way they're constructed. They are very ethereal and sort of vague. There aren't big, strong, heavy, there's no action. The emotion is, you know, there are emotional pyrotechnics, I guess, but these are ethereal stories that just kind of float lightly in the air. And so when you say like, well, this really speaks to me, but I couldn't exactly tell you why, I think maybe that's what he's going for. Like, that's kind of what he wants you to feel. You know, it's not like a Miyazaki movie where you know exactly what he's saying, exactly what he's going for, exactly what these characters are doing, you know, with a few exceptions. But I think that's in line with what the experience he's trying to give you. And I agree that I don't think he's the next Miyazaki, but I think he's his own thing. Clearly an auteur, clearly a respected artist in his own right, and an exciting talent. And it'll be fun to see how he progresses as an artist over the years. I know he's got a new one out, and he's going to be at Otakon. At the end of the month. Yeah, they got him for Otakon, which is pretty cool.
Nice.
So we'll be interviewing him there, and that'll be interesting. But I think your experience is kind of exactly what he's going for. So I guess these movies are exactly on the right wavelength with you, and that's, you know, it's special when you find an artist like that who speaks to you like that.
Right. And I think what is that I think I may have figured out something about it. I really think that his movies are very, or at least his first three right now, which I have affectionately dubbed the Connection Trilogy, because I think it might have been somebody on a Anime News Network who said this, but they said that Voices of a Distant Star was a movie about trying to maintain a connection. Place Promised in Our Early Days was a movie about trying to rekindle a connection. And then 5 Centimeters Per Second was a movie about letting go and moving on from a connection. So when I so that way I feel that his movies are very romantic in the aspect of like as in romanticism, and that when I thought about it like that and I thought about Promised Place, I sort of drew connections, very, very loose connections to things like The Notebook and The Lady of Shalott, in terms of like at the end when the two characters, see, I can't even remember their names because they don't even really have that much personality, but the girl sort of loses loses or forgets about her affections for the boy. And that's in terms of sort of like the Notebook, whereas The Lady of Shalott is sort of, she's in this other world, in this dream world, and she can still see like the airplane that the two boys have been making, in the same way that the Lady of Shalott would see Lancelot riding by towards Camelot. And so I consider myself a fan of romanticism, so maybe on some level that might be where I'm coming from in terms of my fandom with Shinkai's movies, but I don't know.
No, that's a completely accurate point. I think you're definitely onto something there. Although I will say, you're in Arizona, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. See, I grew up in Arizona, just west of Tucson, and I lived there for 23 years. So the notion of building an airplane to get the hell out of Arizona, really, I can totally see how that would appeal to you, sir. I could not get out of Arizona fast enough. But yeah,
that's probably another aspect of it.
Right. I mean, I love to, you know, I love to visit the place, but yeah, never moving back. All right. Well, listen, it was really interesting to talk to you about this. That's cool. It's really fascinating to hear from someone who is having an emotional relationship with a piece of art and an artist. That is kind of rare now, especially in anime. I think, you know, you get these. We have a few auteurs, and people have emotional relationships with the work of those auteurs. But you just, you know, people rarely really express it. So thanks for coming on and talking about that. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
Oh, and before we let you go, you wanted to briefly plug something, right?
Yeah, I am just starting out with doing video, quote unquote, comedic video reviews for anime in the same vein as almost probably every other video critic that people on the internet are familiar with, such as Yezu Otaku, Nostalgia Critic, Spoony, Angry Video Game Nerd. And so I've decided to try it out because I thought it looked like a good time. And I am legitimately enjoying making these videos right now. I only have two out right now, but you can find me on YouTube at Relikai Anime Reviews, and that's RELLIKAI.
Okay, cool. Well, you know, good luck with that project. I know that is a crowded market, so good luck with that. But yeah, if you want to check it out, Relikai Anime Reviews on YouTube. All right, cool, man. Well, thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, joining me next is Nick. How's it going, Nick?
Hi.
What's
How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. What's on your mind, buddy?
Yeah, I just want to talk about Full Metal Alchemist, the differences between the two series, to show people to get their idea on how they're different, how they might like either one.
All right.
Just because I find it such a fascinating topic, just because the strong personality of both Showa Kaiwa and Hiromu Arakawa.
Well, take it away.
The thing that separates them is that Showa Kaiwa is very much a pessimist, a guy who doesn't really... Well, okay, he created Angel Comp, for God's sakes.
Right.
The guy basically made an entire version about how evil the Jews are. Now the United States are going to try to turn Japan into a nuclear waste dump.
Mm-hmm.
Although, frankly, thank God he only kept it to... Christianity doesn't accept people in Full Metal Alchemist.
Right.
On the other hand, Hiromu Arakawa is much more positive. The characters in the manga are much more idealistic. You don't have really... Roy Mustang isn't having sex with everyone except Rise of Hawkeye. On the other hand, I would probably compare it more to something like Lord of the Rings, where in the novels, Faramir is very much a guy who instantly rejects the ring. He's not going to bother with it. Instead, more like where it has in the movies, Faramir is very much tempted by the ring and only lets him go once they figure out that he cannot take the ring to Gondor. He needs to dispose of the ring. And I really find that fascinating.
So you think there's similar differences between the characters in terms of how they're executed?
Oh, yeah. Probably one of the big differences is Scar's brother. In the manga, he wants to use alchemy to better understand the Amestrians, to make the world a more positive place. Whereas in the anime, in the first anime, he wants to return his dead lover back to life.
Right.
And then he goes insane, starts running around the desert without a dick, which is kind of silly.
Yeah.
But it turns out okay.
So which one do you prefer? Do you prefer the...
I would go the manga first, then Brotherhood, and finally the first anime. Although they're all great. It's one of the few series where I ever watched that they actually did a conspiracy theory well instead of just having geared guys talk in big, pretentious voices about how the Pandora box is going to be open. Mm-hmm. Soon, the gates of Enkidu will be opened.
Right. Yeah. No, that's true. I mean, I've got most of Brotherhood. I'm waiting for the last set to come out before I just sit down and marathon it.
So you have watched more of it?
Not since the last time I talked about not having watched more of it. I guess I'm just waiting for it all to show up, and once it all shows up, I'll sit down and get through it. But it's interesting because people get really, really intransient about not intransient. They get really stubborn about adaptations, and it's got to be exactly like the thing they saw before, or it's not any good. And if you just embrace the different versions and, you know, appreciate each one, in a lot of cases, not in all cases, but in a lot of cases, you know, just because the adaptation's different doesn't mean it's worse or objectively bad or something like that. I mean, I personally would rather have it be different than the original source material because I've read the book. You know, I've read the manga. I don't need the anime to be exactly like it. You know, some variation is nice in the story.
Well, I would admit to be guilty of that. I really didn't accept the first version until, really, Brotherhood came out. It wasn't until I rewatched it for a thing I did for Otaku Revolution with Penguin Truth, where I basically discussed the series, the first series, and discussed it with every single episode in him, which was really great.
Right.
And to a certain degree, that's one of the reasons why I think the show failed in Japan, the Brotherhood failed in Japan, was because people were, I think, expecting a repeat of the first anime. They were expecting, you know, Scar to, Mustang to kill the Winry's parents. They were expecting, you know, Ed to be a more flawed character. They were expecting Ed to actually kill people. Whereas in the manga, he never kills a single person.
Right.
Of course,
So Brotherhood was considered a failure in Japan. I actually was not aware of that.
It sold, I think, I got the numbers here. It sold about 12,000 copies, whereas I think the original one sold about 50,000.
Wow.
To put this in comparison, Gundam Seed Destiny sold 64,000.
Well, do you think that part of that is not necessarily because the Japanese rejected the... I mean, the manga is a million-selling thing, right? I mean, it's huge.
Yeah. It was, I think, towards the end, it was the second most popular series in Japan.
Right. So I don't think it's that they were rejecting the story changes. I think they were... First of all, I think the remake happened way too quick. Like, they probably should have given it another couple of years, or maybe wait till an anniversary to do it. Because we just had a Fullmetal Alchemist anime 5 years ago, and now they, you know, they made another one a couple of years later, and it's just... It's a little too much, you know? A little much.
Well, maybe. Here's the thing. I don't... Are people going to want to watch it, you know, 10 years from now? I think that was really what they were wondering. Any version is going to be a risk. I think, unless it's something like Evangelion, which I think news type did like a 90s decade, favorite characters of the decade, pretty much both sides were pretty much just Evangelion characters.
Yeah, I mean, some franchises have a longevity to them that, you know, their popularity endures over the years. I think you can point to something like, you know, Rurouni Kenshin seems to be having a little bit of a renaissance right now. So that's still popular enough to warrant at least, you know, what will probably be a terrible live-action movie. Something like that. But, I mean, Fullmetal Alchemist seems like one of those things where it will still have a fan base in 5-6 years from now. And, you know, maybe they could have gone back 5-6 years from now and said, like, okay, well, now let's do a faithful version of the manga. But I don't know. It seemed like just a little too close to the first one. That's the chief reason I wasn't really interested in it in the first place. I feel like I just finished a 50-episode version of that story. I didn't want to get into another one right away.
Well, it's 50 episodes and an additional movie.
Right, yeah.
That's certainly true. I wouldn't really disagree with that.
So, I don't know. I mean, there's probably something to the fact that they didn't want... I mean, I don't know. That just doesn't stand to reason, because they liked the manga. So if it's exactly like the manga, if Brotherhood's just like the manga, why would they reject it for story purposes?
I don't know. That's why I'm kind of fascinated by the fact that it actually does seem to sell well in America. I'm looking at the Amazon bestseller list, and it's on there for pretty much every part is in, you know, the top 100.
Yeah,
the fifth part is on it as, like, I think it's in the top 10 or something like that.
But at the same time, Brotherhood never recreated the success of the original here either. Like, it's selling nowhere near as well as the original did. It didn't generate much heat when it was on Cartoon Network. Again, and I always chalked it up to the same reason. Like, people just didn't want that same thing again right away. It was just too close. You know, yeah, it's doing okay for them, but it's not a mega hit like the original one. I mean, the original was being sold, you know, in Walmart. It was a big deal.
Are we ever really going to get another mega hit? The anime industry has collapsed in America. You're not getting, you know, we're down to pretty much Funimation now, whereas in 2005 we were still in the boom period. I don't think you can really compare the two, at least in America.
Well, it hasn't collapsed. It's retracted. It's shrank.
Call that shrinking, but...
That's what I would call it. I would call it shrinking.
I don't think, you know, having one company left is... From, you know, 5 major companies in 2005 shrinking.
It's not one company. There's at least 4, and at least 2 of them are doing quite well. Section 23 is actually doing quite well. They're not spending a ton of money on marketing, and they're not releasing giant mega hits, but they're putting out stuff that sells well enough to keep them in business. They've realigned their business plan to something more realistic. They're not trying to take over the world anymore. You know, it's a series of niche publishers that are doing okay, that are keeping their doors open and then, you know, lights on, food on the table. And that's fine. You know, anime is a middle-class industry. It's not a huge, you know, billion-dollar entertainment empire. It's a little thing, and it was always going to be a little thing. You know, just we had a boom period that's over, but it's not like anime is dead in America. That's just not accurate.
Well, you know more than I do.
I was just saying, man. You don't gotta be so pessimistic. You know, look at the bright side. We're still getting stuff. We still have some hits. Not huge, but you're right. We haven't had a mega hit in a long time, and I honestly don't think there's been a series that warranted it since what, like Death Note. I mean, that was kind of it. When's the last like truly like super innovative, really broad with really broad appeal show that we've seen?
That isn't a remake or a sequel?
Yeah.
Full Metal Alchemist.
You're right. There you go.
Yeah. I'm not disagreeing with you.
Yeah, totally. So I would like, I want that more than anything. I'm sure we all do. We want a big hit to come down the road, and we just haven't had one. And that's, I think that's more of a creative problem.
I don't think know what you can do about that, other than get new people.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Okay, man. Well, that's really interesting. Thanks for pointing out those differences. I never thought about it that way before. In terms of the characters being, you know, so different in every incarnation, that's really interesting. So thanks for bringing that up. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for popping my pet podcast, Jerry.
Okay, no problem. All right, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Okay, up next we're talking to Ted. Hi, Ted.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going. What's on your mind, man?
Yes. I was on Amazon.com about a week ago, mm-hmm. Looking at like old box sets from like the early 2000s, looking to see if I can buy them. Like, I was looking at Pat Labor, the early days on, from Central Park Media. They are like $100.
Yeah.
At least $100. Mm-hmm. And like, even like the later stuff, like the later OVAs, they're about the same price. And, I just wonder, like, what's up with the prices?
Well, what you're looking at is a secondary market price. That's not, like, CPM charging that. That's somebody who owns it or a store that had some bad copies or whatever. And all that stuff is out of print, and it's unpopular. And that combination generally drives up the price of something that anyone is interested in. So, you know, and it's never been reissued. There's never been a re-release or anything like that. And they're hard to find. So that's what's going on there. And it's actually happened for a lot of stuff from the early 2000s, in the middle part of the decade. You can go on Amazon and find some truly ridiculous prices for things that are just hard to find. And maybe they were popular in the day or something like that. But it basically just goes to show you, like, if you want something, buy it when it's available. Don't wait forever. Because, like, anyone who didn't buy, you know, Sailor Moon when ADV released it, even though it was expensive when they put it out, it wasn't the $400 it is now.
Yeah, it's really expensive.
You know, so there's a collector's market for that stuff, and it's been out of print for a really long time. I mean, same thing happens with, like, video games. You know, to a bit of a lesser extent, because video games are more likely to get a reprint, or be a little bit more available, but... yeah, it's kind of fun to sit on Amazon and, like, search for old stuff from the 2000s to see what ridiculous prices people are charging. I mean, Cardcaptor Sakura goes for many hundreds of dollars, and that sometimes is just for, like, singles. Like,
Yeah,
like, one volume was particularly hard to get, like, volume 17 was hard to get, so you see it on eBay for $150 or whatever.
My local video store has them all.
Like, sitting in a bargain bin or someplace you can buy them?
No, it's a rental store. It's a mom-and-pop rental shop. We have one here.
You should offer to buy them from them.
I don't think they would.
Throw them up on eBay.
They have volumes 11 and 12 of Oral Battle of the Dumbine there.
That's impressive, yeah. Yeah, that stuff, I mean, it's kind of interesting because there is a collector's market for anime, and specifically a collector's market for all that stuff that came out back then. And the common wisdom that gets thrown around is, oh, this stuff is worthless, no one wants it, you know, or it didn't sell back then. And now it has actually appreciated in value, like people assume, you know, Star Wars figures appreciate in value. And it's all due to just a lack of availability and a small but very steady market that really wants it.
Yeah, like I was at, there's a Suncoast just north of me.
Wow, the last Suncoast, probably.
You would be surprised. I think FYE, I think they still own them like, as a brand name. I think it's just an FYE as named as a Suncoast.
Right, they just didn't pay to change the sign, yeah.
Yeah, I found a box set of the Dirty Pair movies released by ADV Films for, I think, about $35. And I paid it, and I looked on Amazon, and it's like $70.
Yeah.
For a used copy, and a new copy is like $150.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, if you have old media stores around you, and there's very few left in the U.S., like not that many. FYE operates, but they're shutting down a lot of their locations. You know, dig through their anime section. You might be able to find some gems, and not even just if you want to resell them, but if you're looking for this stuff, like, you know, record stores. It's kind of like going to record stores.
Yeah, like, well, most of the titles at FYE, like mine at least, is used stuff mostly.
Yeah.
But you can find some new stuff there. Like, they have the limited edition of the DigiCarrot box set that Cinquepoint released.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, I don't know, like $30. It was pretty cheap. I was surprised that no one bought it.
Really? You're surprised no one bought it?
Well, like 10 years ago.
Yeah, okay,
now,
right.
Now,
yeah.
Not probably, but like, you know, it looked like it was there for about like 10 years. And I didn't see it, and no one bought it. I was surprised about that.
Yeah, if you can find a store that's also really bad about returning unsold items, Fry's Electronics in particular is really, really bad about doing returns. I've mentioned it a few times, but my local Fry's is basically a graveyard for the anime industry, and it's like half just ADV, you know, volume one plus box. that no one's ever going to buy.
Well, see, like I'm near Chicago, and they got one up in Chicago, and they're actually I got to disagree with you. They do kind of return stuff now. Like mostly it's just old, like newer stuff. I've seen they have a huge selection of ADV stuff. Yeah. I don't see that anywhere now. Like it's all gone. Mostly it's Funimation and Media Blasters and Bandai.
Yeah, well, it varies by region. I mean, you know, depending on where you live. I live in Southern California, and Fry's is a franchise, so who knows? You know, this that particular store's buyer for some reason isn't returning anything. And frankly, I don't think I'm not sure what the policy is. I don't know how this works. If anyone can return unsold ADV units, the company technically doesn't exist anymore. So it's that I'd be curious to know. What a retailer who waited too long to do their ADV returns can do with those copies, aside from just leave them to collect dust.
Yeah, I gotta agree with you with that one. Yeah, Chicago is not the best place to buy anime. There's like nowhere to buy anime in Chicago. But like I was in Los Angeles, and like yeah, like a lot of places in there. Like even it's downtown, they got that Jungle place.
Yeah, Jungle. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that. And I mean, they're overpriced, but. Still, like you can just. I'm surprised they have a store, like an anime store, because you don't really have that many up here.
We used to have more. There used to be more around here. I actually had one here in North Orange County that operated for, you know, 4 years, 5 years before I got here, and 4 or 5 years after I got here, and they only recently shut down. But Jungle will stay open. Jungle's in Little Tokyo. And, yeah, I mean, the average media store here does have an anime section. I mean, I've yet to find a Best Buy that doesn't have one, that has completely gotten rid of it, even though I know a lot of them have, or some of them have anyway.
I've seen one.
That has absolutely no anime, aside from, like, you know, like Dragon
there's,
Ball.
There's Miyazaki stuff.
Right. And and they'll always have Dragon Ball. Like, that's always going
to
be there.
Walmart's got Dragon Ball, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That stuff you'll always be able to find. But the retail anime is kind of, I mean, it's sad that it's really kind of died. But it is kind of fun to go treasure hunting. Like, if you find a little old mom and pop media store that's somehow still open, you could find some cool stuff. You find some interesting stuff.
Yeah. What confuses me more about the overpriced DVDs is that, like Justin said, I think that the Pat Labor stuff sold like lead bricks.
Yeah.
And they fetched high prices. I've seen DVDs, I think, I don't know what DVDs, like I know some Criterion stuff that were, I don't know, like laser discs. They can get those cheaper, like $50, $60, like cheaper than the anime stuff.
Yeah,
I just don't
yeah.
know why anime has to be higher than like, you know, like even Criterion stuff has to be cheaper.
Well, it's not like the market itself isn't setting the price here. The secondary market, the seller decides what it's worth. And those prices are the way they are because people are apparently, you know, the odd collector is still paying that. So, you know, that might sit there for 6 months to a year, but eventually it's the only place anyone can find any of this stuff. And if they really want it in their collection, they're going to shell out the 100 bones or whatever. I mean, even for something that sold really, really poorly, if it doesn't exist, if it's not in circulation, you know, there's probably a couple of dusty boxes full of them sitting in a warehouse somewhere that no one's opened for a few years. But those aren't out there in circulation. So, you know,
yeah.
The remaining copies is sort of what people are – the remaining sealed copies is sort of what people are scrapping over. And that's true with any secondary market, any secondary collector's market. Action figures are the same way. Video games are the same way. You know, you go on Amazon, type in Super Mario World. And one of the first results is some store in New York trying to sell a sealed copy for like $600 for Super Mario World. I mean, it's ridiculous, and that's the secondary market for that stuff. You know, just cross your fingers that we never get a kind of, you know, the comic book and action figure grading systems where you send them in your stuff and it comes back and that automatically increases the secondhand market price by like $100 or something like that. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I looked at the Super Mario World stuff. The video game's like $500.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just like a weird thing. I wonder if it's like a niche thing.
Yeah,
like,
of course it is. It's because you have a set ecosystem of collectors that have shown in the past that they're willing to pay these prices.
Yeah.
That's what you're dealing with.
Yes, because like, I know like movies, like, you know, they got a printing. They're still cheap. anime seems to either stay cheap or jack it up.
Well, movies aren't that different. It's just that, you know, anime, a lot of it is out of print and has been out of print for a really long time. But with movies, anything remotely popular is going to get enough of a printing and will stay on shelves long enough. I mean, rare is the film where you're lucky to have it in your possession. Like, it happened with the original Tron last Christmas when Tron Legacy came out. Disney purposefully did not reissue Tron, and it hadn't been reissued on DVD for something like, you know, 7 or 8 years. So there
it is now.
You can get it now. But for up until Tron Legacy's release and for about 4 or 5 months afterwards, you couldn't find a copy of the original Tron for under like $70. And that's just that's how that market works. That's how that secondhand market works. And with anime, there's just a plethora of out of print stuff that is still relatively popular, has a fan base. And so you see it a lot more in anime than you see it really almost anywhere else.
Yeah, I was surprised that Disney didn't released Tron like before the sequel came out.
It was a very specific marketing tactic. They didn't want kids to look at the old Tron and think that that's what the new one was going to be, because it's a cheesy old movie with cheesy old effects. So that was a very specific marketing thing. You can get it now that they've made their money on Tron Legacy, but they really did not want that old movie getting out there. Like, they specifically would not send copies to retailers and stuff, even though there was a heightened demand. All right, Ted, thanks a lot for coming on and chatting with us.
All right, thanks.
Okay, and finally, we're talking to Brian, who I guess you're on Twitter as Nana K Fan.
That's right.
Right. So what's going on, buddy?
Well, I just wanted to talk about to you today about anime pricing and, again, to a smaller extent, manga as well. Basically, what I wanted to talk about was, you know, I joined the anime crowd, I would say around 2004, 2005, you know, and when I was online, you know, a lot of people I saw were talking about how anime, you know, was really expensive, and like you were paying around $30, you know, MSRP for a single disc, and if you were lucky, you know, you could find it on Right Stuff or other websites for maybe $25, $20. And I'm looking online today, and I mean, I still see people going, hey, this is way too expensive for a lot of the new titles that come out. And I'm looking at it going, are you kidding me? Because it looks great to me today. Like, I can buy, I buy Blu-rays at like $41 brand new. Yeah. And these are 12 episode sets. And in like 2004, my first set that I bought, I paid $120 Canadian for it. And I mean, that was a thin pack, re-release. So I'm kind of looking at it today going, well, you guys that, you know, that are kind of talking about how anime is priced still too high, I think, you know, it's kind of a little bit crazy.
Well, we have it better now than we've ever had it. You know, the standard now is about $50 for like a 26 episode series on DVD. And the sale price, like, you know, you're not going to pay $50. You're going to pay 36 or something like that, whatever the Right Stuff standard Amazon deduction is. Blu-ray is going to cost you about $50. And that's from, you know, Sentai or Funimation. We have some niche publishers like NISA and Aniplex that are experimenting with, you know, premium product and a little higher pricing. And Aniplex is specifically doing sort of Japanese pricing. And those are, you know, those are, I don't want to say minor players, but they're not shaping the industry as a whole.
I think companies like Aniplex and, you know, even Bandai to an extent, they're more aiming towards the niche crowd. Like, they're going, okay, well, you're looking for these specific titles, and so we're going to have to charge a little bit more because they're not exactly, you know, all the big action titles that, like, companies like Funimation and Sentai, they're the companies that usually pick those up. Like, Funimation, you know, just recently licensed Dead Man Wonderland. And to me, that was no surprise. You know, it's a mainstream action title. It kind of, you know, it's got a lot of blood, you know, fighting in it. And yeah, I assume, you know, they're going to pick that up. But when you look at a title like, even when you look at Nisa, you know, they're picking up Enma-kun, they're picking up Kimi no Todoki. I probably mangled the pronunciation of that. But they're picking up stuff that isn't really going to sell that well. And I think, you know, with a company like Nisa, they charge the premium for that because they understand they're going, you know, for the premium customers, the people that want to buy those collectibles. And so I think for them, you know, the making those big, huge boxes, making the packaging part of that premium price, I think that's definitely worth it. I mean, for me, like, I got the Toradora set, I bought Persona from them, and I mean, those packages are great, and for me, it was totally worth the price. And if you want to wait later on, they do have the you know, the regular sets at a lower price.
Yeah, it's a different business plan. But when it comes to complaining about prices, there's a variety of factors at work. Some people are complaining about pricing because they're teenagers and they don't have any money. And so $50 seems like $50 may as well be $1 million when you're broke and 15 and you just want to
yeah,
buy something.
The thing I think most is that I've seen is that a lot of people kind of treat anime as a secondary hobby. Like when you see people complaining about, oh, hey, this anime is priced way too high, they're also going, well, I've got my budget for my video games. I've got Blu-ray movies, you know, American movies I want to buy. All this anime should come second. And I can't do that when, you know, they're charging $50 to $60 for this product. You know, they need to price it down a little bit more to fit my budget.
Well, there's, like I said, variety of factors. Some of them are teenagers. Some people, it's just never going to be cheap enough because they didn't get into anime as a hobby that involves buying things. They got into anime because they got exposed to fan subs, and so anime is inherently disposable to these people. It's not a collector item. They're really not the market. They're not the market for what, like, Funimation isn't necessarily targeting fan sub guy who, you know, it's never going to be cheap enough, because the secret justification that he's using is, I can just download everything I want for free and nobody's ever going to prosecute me for that or anything. So I can justify never having bought anything by the fact, oh, this is too expensive. It's not compared to other things. Anime is priced at a little bit of a premium. Yes, it's more expensive than American television shows for the most part. But not by much. And it's complaining about price, to me, it's never because it's actually too expensive.
And that's what I agree with as well. Like, I mean, you know, but I see it a lot where people will just go, oh, you know, a new show comes out and they go, I want to get this. But, oh, they're charging way too much. You know, it's a ripoff.
There are a few exceptions here. I am not shocked or taken aback, nor necessarily disagreeing with people complaining about some of Aniplex's prices. They want $50 for that shitty Rony Kenshin movie, you know, the one based on the TV show. They want $50 for that on Blu-ray. That's insane. That's the Japanese pricing at work. And that's okay, fine. That's just not realistic in this market. They might sell out. That's probably got a really low print run. You know, I understand why they're doing it. I disagree with it, but I mean, other than that, anime is not that expensive. It just isn't. If you're an adult with a job, it's not expensive, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, there's definitely going to be the exceptions to it where, you know, where something definitely is, why did you price it that way? Like when you look at the ROD, the TV Blu-ray box they released, I believe it's going for like 150 to somewhere to $200. I don't have the price on hand, but I looked at it and I went, well, you're releasing this older show. And it's on Blu-ray and it's a nice box, but it already got released. You can still find the singles, I believe, you know, for a relatively cheap price. You're pricing it too high for a show that, you know, everybody's already seen. And I mean, yeah, with the other Aniplex, some other Aniplex stuff, I definitely agree there. And I mean, the one big thing that I've seen is the one company I've seen targeted the most with the, well, this is priced too high, is Bandai Entertainment. I have a beef with that because a lot of people seem to kind of have a misunderstanding of Bandai in particular. I don't agree with their release really of K-On, where they decided to go with the singles route again, especially with the Blu-ray. I kind of looked at that and went, well, I thought we were out of that stage, you know, four episodes a disc, like that isn't the market it is today. But a lot of people looked at it and go, well, why is Bandai picking up this show if they can't afford to release it in a sets, or why is Bandai releasing these shows sub only, like seven episodes a disc at $25 a disc? And a lot of the comments I saw as well, can't Bandai just use, you know, their Japanese counterpart? And I'm kind of going, well, they don't work together. Like Bandai Entertainment is you know, their own North American company. They don't get that Gundam money. Like, they have to license Gundam from them, but usually that's going to not make them money because Gundam fans are a small market here.
Well, Bandai Entertainment takes direct marching orders from Japan.
Yeah, I don't think they get any operate. Money from Japan. Yeah.
Well, they have to be profitable on their own.
Yeah.
You know, they decide what's going to be released here. Generally, that decision's made in Japan. They put it out. They decide on a release strategy. And a certain percentage of that profit has to be able to pay for the American office, basically. And that's pretty much how it operates there. In terms of, like, K-On, you know, that's a strategy. I think they were under the impression, and I have no idea how it is sold, so can't really comment on that. But that's a super, super niche show with a super hardcore mega fan base that probably complained about the singles and bought them anyway. That's what I'm going to
assume. That's what I did.
Right, exactly. Like, why are they releasing it this way? Oh, well, here's my money because I really love the show. But you can really only do that with a show that's like super hardcore fan base, like people who are willing to, you know, shell out the money for it. You know, like Garden of Sinners from Aniplex. That was absolutely a release success. You could not buy it on the day it came out. It sold out really quick. And it was $400 for 8 movies. And that was a huge success, but that's the only time you're going to see success like that is because Type Moon has crazy super mega fans who will buy it at that price. And so it's all a matter of deciding which titles that release strategy is going to work for. And, you know, I guess I'm biased because I don't care what their release strategy is so long as it's making them money. The industry is so small now, and I don't think they're doing anything to intentionally screw the fans. It's like, look, we have to do things this way in order to continue to be able to release things. Nobody's getting rich off of anime. It's not like they put out K-On! In singles and Bob Napton is buying his 5th Lamborghini. You know, that's just not how it works.
Oh, and I totally agree with you. And I think that's one of the problems that I think that a lot of fans maybe have is that when they're looking at it, they're just looking at it from their perspective going, okay, well, it doesn't really fit my budget. It's not how I want it. And they don't look well. If they release it at this price, will the company make money off of it? Like, okay, I get it. It might not be best for me, but it's how the company needs to work. And they don't really want to look at it from that aspect. Like, okay, it's about me. And if the company doesn't make money off of that, oh, well, as long as they released it how I wanted to release it.
Well, yeah. And, you know, the other thing is that fan culture, especially in anime, is very, and it's very entitled. And they sort of act as though a lot of people do. Obviously not everybody, but you see this attitude a lot.
Sure.
You see this attitude a lot where it's like, look, if you don't do it this way, I'm just going to keep my fan subs. I already have the product. Like, I'm buying this almost as a favor to you. So you do it the way I say you're going to do it or I don't buy it. And a lot of fans have that attitude, and that's different. That's rare. Like, even in video games, people are like, you better do it this way, but I don't want to hack my Xbox, so gonna buy it no matter how you release it, you know.
And that's definitely something I've seen, like the culture, you know, in anime. I've seen usually when a company releases something, they're not looking, why should I buy the show? It's usually a, why shouldn't I buy the show? What did they do wrong with it? Like, they'll look at it and go, oh, it's not, you know, 1080p at this video quality, so many episodes this price, well, I'm gonna pass on it. Oh, look, it's Viz releasing it, I don't like Viz even though I love the show, okay, I'm going to pass on it. And, you know, that kind of makes me sad because it's like, okay, well, I don't like Viz that much, but when they release Nana, it's like, well, Nana's my favorite show, so regardless of the thoughts I have on them, I'm going to pick it up because I love the show. You know, I couldn't care more, you know, less for Viz as a company because they've screwed up some releases for me, but I still want that show, where someone's going to go, well, I like the show, but don't like Viz, so it's a pass.
Yeah, well, you know, everybody's got their weird little reasons for doing something or not doing something. And I think some people get a little too caught up in the, how is this released? Is it up to my personal standards? Well, then I will tell the internet that I am not going to purchase this. You know, like, anyone gives a shit. I mean, a lot of this is just posturing. You have to understand, like, it's just people online going, well, this, you know, there's no insert card, so no sale, you know. And I think a lot of it is just posturing. You know, and people who were never going to buy it in the first place go on forums and complain about why they're not going to buy it. You know, it's the internet, you know. It's hard to tell how many of these people are actually sincere and realistically, what are the actual reasons people don't buy anime? And rarely, I think, is it the price. I think in Aniplex's case, certainly it's probably the price a lot of the time. But, you know, I don't hear a lot of people bitching nonstop about Funimation's prices anymore. I really don't.
Yeah, they're the ones that I think have mostly come out okay. But when you look at you know, the smaller publishers, of course, like Aniplex and the other ones, I mean, a lot of people will use them to compare to Funimation and go, hey, well, they're not doing it according to them. And of course, you still got people go, like, you know, not as much, but you still have the odd person going, well, even Funimation's is way too high. So, I mean, I'm kind of looking at it and like, well, where do we draw the line? What's too high? Because again, yeah, I can, like, when High School of the Dead came out, even when I pre-ordered it, it was in the weekly specials that were right stuff, and I bought it for $42, and I was like, well, this is pretty much a steal, you know. This is like $80 less than I paid for their noir thin pack, you know, way back when. Yeah. So I'm perfectly happy.
Yeah, I mean, again, like, a lot of these people, they subconsciously understand but don't express, or they know it and it's just a smokescreen. Any price is too high. It doesn't matter. Because anime is basically free to so many people, and they view it as a free thing, something they don't pay for, you know, a penny an episode is too much. And it's
for sure.
That's just the culture. That's the culture that has grown since 1997 or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I wanted to bring up though as well, it was a while back, but I want to switch into manga here. A while back, you had a talk with, I believe it was Sean from Right Stuff. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that was mentioned with manga was that a lot of the reason that people don't buy the manga online was because the big reason was, you know, we don't know if it's going to finish.
Yeah.
I would say that the problem for me with buying manga online was I like the price. Like, it's pretty much cheaper than I can get anywhere. But the problem for me with manga online is that when I look at, you know, like a place like Right Stuff, half the titles are like that I look at usually have a whole bunch of volumes out of stock. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at it going, well, when are they going to come into stock? Because when I was looking at, when I was getting Berserk, it was like volume 26 or something at the time was out of stock. And I was looking at it, and no place had it, and it took about 6 months for it to get back into stock. And I'm just looking at it when people are going, hey, you know, we're not seeing that great of manga sales online. I think that's kind of the reason behind it, is that people are looking at it going, okay, well, say I want to get into like Fairy Tail or something like that, but look, they only have volumes 1 through 4 online. And then, you know, 5, 7, and 8 are out of stock, and then they have the rest in stock. Well, that kind of goes, well, do I want to get this, or do I want to go with this other series where, you know, it's only 4 volumes, but it's all in stock? And that's all something I wanted to comment on, because that's pretty much me. I look at it and I go, well, I want something to read, you know, almost right away, you know, in a couple of weeks. And if I have to wait a certain unknown amount of time, I'm probably going to pass on that series.
Yeah. Well, that was Sean's point exactly. That's what he was saying, was that part of the reason manga sales suffer online is because publishers don't keep everything in print. They don't do reprints very often. They don't always have things printing. So if you have a big, long series, and for whatever reason, volume 18 didn't sell very well for them, so they stopped printing it for a while, so it goes out of stock, so people don't buy it online because they see they can't get the whole thing. It's a problem. Like, it's a problem. There's no way to go to the publisher and say, hey, could you waste a whole bunch of money publishing, printing this book that people don't seem to be buying over and over and over again, because there's one or two people who are looking at it on Right Stuff and seeing that, you know, that one volume is out of stock, and so it's going to prevent them from reading the whole thing, and no one wants to miss a single volume. It's a really complicated problem. And if I remember correctly, Sean just was basically saying, like, boy, I wish they would just keep this stuff in print because we'd sell a lot more copies. Like, all they have to do is just keep printing them and people will keep buying them. But I bet if you talk to the publishers, they'd say, well, there's no guarantee that people are gonna keep buying them. I mean, I've run into this problem myself. I actually had a similar problem with Berserk, where I stopped collecting it for a little while because I was getting tired of all the monster rape, and I decided to go back to it. And it was some volume. It was like, I think it was a couple of volumes before that. Just couldn't find it online. It wasn't, you know, Amazon was sold out. They didn't have any individual sellers. And I know this isn't a solution for everybody, but my solution for this stuff is conventions. I just go to a local con. There's usually a manga dealer there, and they usually have this stuff. You know, they've got it in a little beat-up cardboard box. But I've never had a real problem finding missing volumes at conventions. I know that's not a solution for everybody, but...
Yeah, like I was just going to say, that's probably not the best solution for me because I'm, like, way out in the boonies in Western Canada, and I think, like, the best convention I can get is in, Calgary, which is, like, 2 hours away from me, and, you know, I don't always have the time to go to that convention.
Yeah, it's not always a solution, but, you know, it's a weird problem, and it's similar in comics, I think. If you're looking for certain back issues and they're just out of stock, it's complicated. I don't know necessarily how you solve it. Although I have to admit, like, I was a little weirded out by having trouble finding volumes of Berserk because I just assume that people are buying that and they're gonna keep it in print. But I guess once you get up to a certain number of volumes, maybe it just gets intimidating and people are like, "Yeah, look, I am not going to start a 37 volume thing. That's a lot of money. Not to mention, you know, it's a lot of money."
That could definitely be it too. And what I wanted to also mention is, like, yeah, you know, with a lot of manga, people say, you know, hey, you know, you're paying 10, 15 bucks a volume or something like that for these manga titles. And for me, it's like, well, I'm paying, you know, it's definitely, you know, you have less time to read the titles. Like, you can blow through a manga title maybe about in half an hour, if, you know, you're a quick reader, even less. And so people are going, well, 10, 15 bucks for just one little comic is way too much. And for me, you know, with Berserk, the thing that I like to do is I reread my manga all the time. So I've probably gone through what's out of Berserk, you know, two or three times over. And I just kind of want to go, well, you're paying 10 or 15, you know, 10 to 15 bucks for those volumes. But then again, you know, you can pretty much bring them anywhere you want. And if you wait, like, maybe, you know, half a year or something like that, you can reread those titles. So even though you're paying maybe 10, 15 bucks, you know, a volume, after a while, you know, it's going to pay for itself because you always have it with you. You can bring it wherever you want, and eventually you're going to get the value out of it back.
Well, yeah, okay. I think you may be a special case. I think for a lot of people, manga is disposable just like anime is, and they read it once, and, well, that was nice, and then move along. And I kind of like the e-reader solution. Like, I really want to catch up on One Piece, but I don't have the shelf space for that much. Like, it's too much. It's just too much material in my house. So I'm looking forward to being able to catch up on One Piece on an e-reader. But, yeah, I mean, I'm never going to reread One Piece. I don't know, maybe. I don't reread a lot of stuff, but... Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, probably, I guess I am a special case in that. But for me, you know, whenever I have a manga series, you know, after a while, like with, especially with Berserk, you know, the wait between volumes is so long. You know, about a year or more. So after a while, I go, well, I can't even remember what's happened between the, you know, between the last volume and this volume. So after a while, it's like, well, I'm just going to go ahead and reread my whole series because I've got it right at my fingertips here. And, you know, I'll go ahead and reread it, catch up, and go, okay, well, now all this volume makes sense.
I think in the case of something like Berserk, I could totally see it. And I reread the Nausicaa manga like once every 2 years or so, maybe 3 years. And, you know, my super favorites, like the stuff I consider like, you know, eternal classics, yeah, I'll go back and revisit them. But most of this stuff, I think, is considered disposable for a reason. It's just an entertainment product. But, yeah, I don't know.
You'd never go back and reread Bleach?
No. No. I was unable to get through, like, even, like, 3 episodes of Bleach. I know everyone tells me it gets good, but I just don't have the patience.
Oh, I think it gets worse.
All right. Well, we're about out of time. But that was great fun, and it was good talking to you, man. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on the show. Appreciate it.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to everybody for showing up last minute on a weekend. Really appreciate that. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band New Division. Check them out at newdivision.net. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave a little review, maybe a star rating. We appreciate it. See you all next week.